Hey, you guys. It's Monday. Yeah. We're turning around like Pookie's like, I'm going to tear up your shit.
What the fuck are you doing, bud? Okay, so 24-hour party people. It's a good movie. It's about the Manchester scene with Joy Division, and even mentioned like the Sex Pistols and Susie and the Banshee and all the fucking players that were in that scene, and you know, like mostly the money guys, the guys who had the money and tried to put all that stuff together. It's comical and it's historical, and a lot of legendary shit happens in it. They fucking weave in actual footage. It's a good flick. I liked it.
This is actually probably one of my favorite movies of all time. I guess one of the reasons I really like it, because I don't know, like, if you're not really into post-punk or kind of like the rave scene that kind of came out of Manchester, England in the early 90s, then you might not get as much out of it.
Well, goth on the side, too.
But yeah, that as well. Right. So
Where it came from.
I kind of feel like that's probably why I'm super into it, because, you know, that whole Manchester scene, there's so many like Manchester bands that I was into, like Joy Division and The Fall and The Smiths and stuff like that.
Another thing I liked about it is that they talk about the evolution of nightclubs.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the shit I took for granted, you know, because I lived through it, I forgot how it used to be. Like my Uncle Red, he came up in nightclubs that were centered around music scenes. In other words, bands. If you didn't have bands, you didn't have a fucking club. They found out later when rave happened, and I kind of forgot about that, bands kind of vanished. Because you didn't need them. They were just an unnecessary overhead. Who became famous was the DJ. The DJ, the club, and his set. Which we got Maniac in, he'll tell you. The Rise of the DJ. It was a fucking good film for explaining this kind of shit to people that are like in their 20s and 30s. I told Nick about it. He goes, oh yeah, I gotta see that. I heard about it. And he just takes it for granted that nightclubs involve dancing and DJs.
Yeah.
Wasn't always that like that. But I forgot.
Yeah, this does a good... Yeah. I mean, the movie, I really kind of like the way... Because this is a very sprawling topic, I mean, pretty much. But I like the way they filtered all of it kind of through Tony Wilson. Because Tony Wilson, who was a real guy, he's passed away. But he was a TV presenter in the UK. And he kind of became instrumental because he got so into the burgeoning punk and post-punk movement after seeing the Sex Pistols in Manchester in 1976. And he kind of used his TV show, which was just kind of local to the Manchester area, as a platform to show a bunch of bands that weren't really getting any traction, like on other TV shows or other radio stations in the country. So he was kind of like instrumental in doing that, and he got so into it that he started a record label, and then later on also ended up co-partnering in a club, which later became the Hacienda, where kind of was the birth of rave culture in the late 1980s. And so he was kind of like, so I like that they filtered it through that. Now this movie too, so like I said, it's very like anarchic. It does have real shit in it, and it actually weaves in kind of real footage, like real footage of the Sex Pistols at Susie. Manchester, like Lesser Free Trade Hall, real stuff of like, you know, the Buzzcocks and the Stranglers and all this other, and Susie and all this kind of stuff. So they weave that in there, but they kind of make it, you know, but then they kind of like put in the fictional stuff as well.
They also bring in real people from those bands and weave them into the fictional story, like, you know, playing roles.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like fucking bellhops and shit, you know what I mean? Or whatever.
Yeah.
Guys, that's running drains.
It's kind of funny because, well, some people are in there like playing themselves.
Yeah.
Like Mark E. Smith from The Fall has like a cameo, but he's just kind of playing himself, like he's in the line, like waiting to be in the club or whatever. But they do have like a lot of like the real Tony Wilson, who Steve Coogan plays in the movie. He has a cameo as I think he's like the director or the producer of like the Wheel of Fortune show. So he has like one scene, and then they have Howard Devoto from the Buzzcocks and magazine, and he's kind of like playing like a janitor, like cleaning the bathroom.
Yeah.
So
doesn't one of them play a fucking conductor, rail car conductor? Wasn't that one of them?
Rail car conductor. Oh yeah,
gets
yeah,
on
yeah.
The train.
That's right. Yeah. That was actually. Oh, I can't remember who that was. That might have been Paul Ryder, like, from Happy Mondays, but I could be remembering it wrong. Because it's funny, this movie, it's very postmodern in the sense that it's reality, but also legend.
Interview
and stuff like that. Yeah. And it also, like, breaks the fourth wall. So you're basically having Steve Coogan as Tony Wilson talking to you, the audience. And also acting as though, yes, this is a film. You know what I'm saying? So he goes back at some point. He's like, there's a lot of real people in this. Like, and he'll go back and, like, show the stills of, like, hey, this is so-and-so from whatever. So, you know what I mean?
I like how they did it. It's basically kind of like how they did it in Goodfellas. He's telling you his career, how he got to where he got. And remember how Goodfellas was?
Yeah.
Breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience. He does all that. And tells how he kind of went from a television guy into a club guy. And how fucking stupid they were when it came to money, which the shit's
It wasn't
hilarious.
So much stupid. He knew and he just didn't care.
Man.
He was kind of like, it's funny because even though one of my favorite things about this movie is that one of the marketing things has like a picture of Sean Harris, who played Ian Curtis, and it said genius on it. And then it had a picture of the guy that played Sean Ryder from Happy Mondays, and it said poet on it. And then it had a picture of Steve Coogan playing Tony Wilson, and it said twat. Which I thought was like really, really funny.
He was a cool guy, but man, he's wasting $30,000 on a table.
Yeah.
Sending fucking bands who were drug addicts out to fucking Barbados and they're gone for fucking 2 years.
They gave him £200,000 and that's all they did was fucking buy drugs with it.
Yeah, and then just dumb shit. Fucking not having any of these bands on fucking proper fucking contracts, and then a company just shows up and wants $5 million to buy Factory Records, and he goes, "Well, I can't sell it to you because I don't have a contract." And just,
well, he's like, "I don't have a back catalog, and I don't have any contracts to sell you."
And which was fucking, man, that $5 million would have saved the club, you know. And there was just a lot of stuff, and those bands would have been better off in the hands of somebody else, probably somebody who'd crack their whip on them. And but, you know, they just didn't take it seriously.
And as I said, I kind of feel like his whole thing was, one, he was very, very averse to selling out, and he just cared about the music and the Manchester scene, and he just wanted to disseminate the music because he thought it was important.
Yeah. His thinking was wrong, though.
But but you could you could say that he was almost kind of like the distillation of the punk rock attitude because he completely did not care
about the money,
about money at all. He just cared about the artists. He wanted them to do what they wanted to do. Like I said, it probably didn't work out so good in a lot of cases because, like I said, you know, some like the Sean Ryder from Happy Mondays, they sent him off to Barbados to make a record and he spent it all on drugs and he didn't do any vocals and all this other kind of shit.
Yeah, and that was money that could have gone to the club and things that fucking make more albums or get more bands. The bands would have been better off if they had somebody who was fucking harder on them, probably, or you get rid of them, one of the two, and replace them with another band that could do something. And then even if you're harder on those bands, they end up making more money, so they're richer and they have more product to put out. He just didn't really have a business mindset, but he's admitting that in the movie.
Well, yeah, like I said, that wasn't really his goal. And honestly, you could argue that people nowadays are still talking about Joy Division and still talking about Factory and still so he was actually successful in the way that he wanted to be successful.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people still remembered it and it was important.
Answered some of my questions about Ian Curtis and fucking Joy Division. I didn't imagine him being like that. He was kind of hostile. I imagined him being kind of quiet, but he was.
He was, but it depended. Yeah. Well, he was a bit laddish, which a lot of people were in Manchester at the time because they were all just kids. I mean, they were all working class. You have to think that Ian Curtis and stuff like that, like when that happened, like when they first saw the Sex Pistols, they were only in their teens.
Yeah.
Like late teens.
If you never heard any Joy Division, go listen to it. Go like Love Will Tear Us Apart or fucking Transmission or something. And it, or listen to the fucking Closer album, which is white. It's really good. And it, when you listen to those lyrics, you in that voice, you think a wise old man is talking to you, not some kind of dumb kid. But it sounds like a fucking wise old man.
Yeah, he wasn't dumb, but he did have like a lot of problems. And
dumb
honestly, yeah. But the thing about it is, I think a lot of that could be attributed to. I mean, he was just like a melancholy person all around.
Must have been some kind of mental problem. Like,
no. Well, what it was mainly. I mean, there was a lot of other factors. If you've ever want, if I mean, this movie, it's it kind of skips over a lot of stuff. If you want to see something that's just about Joy Division, there's a movie called Control, which is actually really good. This one kind of is more focused on, like, it's a lot of stuff about Joy Division. It does cover his suicide and stuff like that, but it's kind of about the whole scene. So they're kind of like in the first half, but then it goes on. But I read his widow's book. And one of his major things, there was a lot of things going on, but one of his major things was that he had really, really bad epilepsy. Like, one of the most severe cases that the doctors had ever seen. And it really started getting bad in 1978 to the point where not only, obviously, was he not allowed to drive, he every time he performed, they couldn't have flashing lights, obviously, because it would trigger a seizure pretty much every time. So if the lighting person wasn't on board with that and started doing flashing lights, he would, you know, he would have a fit and he would, like, fall over. Sometimes, like, certain percussion, like, when also caused him to have a seizure. One time he had a seizure in the bathroom and hit his head on the sink and it knocked him out and they didn't know where he was. They even advised him, like, when he had his baby daughter, they said, we would advise you, like, not to hold her because you could have a fit and you could drop her on her head. So so they were trying to, like, figure out what medication to, you know, because they said pretty much this is going to impact your whole entire life. Like, we can give you some medication and it will maybe help you, but this epilepsy is, like, really, really bad and this is going to, like, pretty much haunt you your whole entire life. And it was getting worse, like, as time was going on, and they weren't really figuring out. And the drugs also had really bad side effects. Like, it was he couldn't really sleep all that well. It was doing, like, these really big mood swings. It was doing all this kind of stuff. So I'm sure that really didn't help. You know, like I said, there was some other stuff going on. Like, his wife had just filed for a divorce because he was having an affair, allegedly. And she told him she would give him a chance, like, hey, if you don't, like, have contact with her anymore, she was a Belgian girl, then I'll call it off. But, you know, there was, so that was that. And like I said, he just had a baby. I don't think he, and they were going to tour America. Like, he actually, like, hanged himself, on the night before they were going to go to America. He thought, according to people that knew him, they said it wasn't so much that he was, one, he hated to fly, which I get. But he thought that when he got to the U.S. and started doing shows, that he would have a fit on stage and everyone would laugh at him. So there was that as well. So he was really, really sensitive about it because he thought it made him look ridiculous or whatever. So he had, like, a lot of problems. And what they didn't say this in the movie, but he had actually attempted suicide before, like, about, like, a month or 6 weeks or something like that before he actually did it. He did attempt suicide before, and Tony Wilson and his wife or girlfriend at the time, Lindsay, who they've portrayed in this movie, they actually let him stay at their house for a little while and kind of, like, were talking him down from that. So they knew that he was, you know, that he was in danger of doing that. But the thing about it, like I said, this is the late 1970s or 1980 when he did it, and mental health kind of stuff, it wasn't really something you talked about. Like, even the other band members in Joy Division were like, they were just kind of kids too, and they're like, well, we didn't really know how to help him, and it's like, and he was trying to make it seem like it wasn't as bad as it was. So whenever we asked him, like, we were worried about him, like, he just said, no, it's fine. So I don't think they really understood, like, the depth of all the shit that he was going through, because it just wasn't something that that young dudes talked about, like, young working class dudes talked about.
They get into the band New Order slightly in this, which came from Joy Division. In some ways, New Order, I think, might have been better. It was recorded a lot better.
I mean, I like Joy Division better. I mean, yeah. I like New Order, too. I mean, New Order were massively successful. Yeah. Like, you know, probably way more. I think Joy Division was more influential. I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. It's kind of
Joy Division was darker. It was more like goth.
Yeah, it's two slightly different kinds of music, yeah. I guess, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the funny things that they say about it is that, you know, when Blue Monday came out, the 12-inch single... And they said, you know, it was the biggest selling 12-inch single of all time, but because of the design of it, which was supposed to look like a big floppy disk, which if you kids today don't know what that is, but it's supposed to look like a big floppy disk, so it had like a cutout in the middle, and it was just like had this gatefold. It was a beautiful cover. But they say this movie is like, we lose what, 5 pence, like every one of these we sell just because the graphic design on it was so expensive because of like all the cutouts and everything like that. But that was one thing where Tony Wilson just like, he liked the design so much that he didn't care that it cost more to like print it and make it than they made off it when they sold it. Cause they sold like a fuck ton of them, but.
Yeah.
It's just kind of the same thing about when he opened the Hacienda, which at first when he was having bands play there, you know, it wasn't really, you know, they'd have like 3 people show up or something like that. But for whatever reason, there was all this kind of like synergy when rave first started to come around in the late 1980s, when he got Happy Mondays involved and everything like that. And the members of New Order also had a lot of money in that club as well. And it all just kind of came together, and then the place was like the place to be, like in Manchester, and then it was fucking packed, and it was just kind of like the kind of ground zero of the rave scene. That was essentially where, like you said, the nightclub where everybody's cheering the DJs rather than bands.
Yeah.
Everybody just went to dance and ecstasy, but the club, even though zillions of people showed up, kept losing money because everybody was on ecstasy.
They weren't buying it.
Buying drugs from illegal drug dealers, and they weren't buying booze.
Yeah.
So that caused a lot of problems. So they had a lot of people in there, but they weren't drinking, so they weren't like paying. And also, they had a lot of gang violence later on and stuff like that, you know, because of all the drug dealers coming in and shooting one another and shit like
that. Yeah, they couldn't keep the drug dealers out, and they were afraid to turn the drug dealers away. They're in England, and they got guns. So the security isn't armed, so they can't...
Well, and I think sometimes they made some of the drug dealers like the door guys.
Yeah.
Like, because they were trying to mitigate the problem somewhat.
Right.
Because they did kind of try to do it, but like I said, they weren't real... They didn't really care about, like... Well, he didn't. I thought the funniest thing about this, and I was the unsung here. Everybody in this is good. Steve Coogan is fucking hilarious. I mean, he started out as he's a lot better known in Britain when this movie came out than he was over here because he had the Alan Partridge Show where he plays a character that has like a talk show. But I think this was America's first like widespread, movie that they'd seen him in. But I want to say one of the unsung heroes of this movie is Patty Considine, who plays Rob Gretton, who was Joy Division and New Order's manager. That dude, he was like the tall dude with the glasses. That dude is fucking hysterical in this. Yeah. I kind of wish it would... Because he's sort of like the voice of reason. Like, the whole hilarious thing when they finally opened Factory Records... Because for a long time, Factory Records was just like a thing. It was just like a collective. They didn't have offices or contracts or anything like that. So finally, Tony Wilson, like way in the late 80s, decides he's going to open up an office, and he gets this ridiculous table.
Stupid ass.
That's like, it's like this red, like lucite, I don't know what it is, but it's like this really long table. It's all like wavy and shit.
Yeah, it's got fucking...
And it's got like
metal wires.
It looks like the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, going
shit.
Up. Just
and like, he shows everybody in there. He's like, look, we finally have offices and stuff. And everybody's like, oh, that's quite a table. And he's like, how much did you pay for it? And he says, £30,000. And there's a pause.
That's like $60,000.
And then Rob Gretton like runs at him and is like,
yeah,
like starts
immediately
dragging.
Attacks him. Immediately attacks him like that. And they're trying to break
it's
the fight
so
up.
Fucking funny.
Which is fucking, was the kind of way, I would have done the same thing, man. Like $60,000. It would look like a piece of shit. All right, it looked like something that a cheap studio somewhere, cheap art studio with Axel Foley walking around in it. Fucking Beverly Hills. It's obviously something made out of nothing. You know what I mean? You could put it together for like a maybe a grand, a couple grand. out of fucking shit from the hardware store. That's what it was.
Yeah.
I'd have kicked that motherfucker's ass, $60,000.
Well, yeah, that's what, I just think that's funny because Rob Gretton was just kind of like...
In a business that's basically going under and not really, just barely treading water, you know, I'd have kicked his ass. Yeah. He's crazy. He was crazy. Crazy.
He was a little bit
fucking crazy,
but he was very aware.
And yeah, he was forced to walk away from a £5 million offer. That's $10 million.
Yeah, London Records was going to buy. Well, they were going to buy out the whole. Yeah, because they wanted Happy Mondays.
Yeah, but the $10 million you could have taken and just reinvested into a fucking huge business because they didn't have $10 million in that. And he had the street cred to attract an all new regime of bands. You know, he could have done it again. You know, a lot of dudes do that. That's how, or they could have just retired rest of his life.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, he had money.
They would have had to divide it up.
He had money because he was on TV. Like, so he still had, and he was on TV like the whole time.
Yeah, and that's a pittance.
So yeah, but I mean, he had a, so he had his own money, but you know what I mean?
He's lucky to make a couple $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
They offered him fucking $10 million.
£5 million
is $10 million.
I don't know how much it was back then, but yeah, that was probably something.
In general, talking about the '80s, late '80s, early '90s, yeah. I think a pound was about $2 or $1.75, something like that.
I mean, but
I'd have been frustrated, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people were, but
you're right.
It's just kind of like, I just really liked, because he's just such a lovable character in this, because like I said, he clearly does not know anything, or I guess he knows about, but he doesn't really care one way or the other. I mean, like at the end when actually the Hacienda got repoed, and they were having their big last night there. It was like a big party. And like at the end, like when the guy came to repossess it, he says to everybody, he says, invade the offices and loot them. Yeah. Take it all. Because they were like taking it all away. But it's just like, he was just, I don't know. Like I said, he just thought that it was like, he says at the end, he was explaining that his big sin was like civic pride, because he loved Manchester so much.
Yeah.
And he really wanted, and he thought all this music was important and it was going to, you know, resonate throughout, which it did. I mean, he was right about that. And I thought it was cool. I mean, this movie was directed by Michael Winterbottom and written by Frank Cottrell Boyce, who are both also from Manchester. And I believe Steve Coogan is also originally from Manchester as well. So this was just kind of like a real homegrown, you know, everybody there was kind of like, oh, you got to check your...
I got to check the chicken.
Yeah. But, I mean, seriously. I do love Patty Considine in this. I kind of wish he'd been in it a little bit more. But just because he's such a good foil for Steve Coogan's character. I mean, this just, like, the conversations they have are just, like, so fucking funny. Just and he just has, like, impeccable comic timing, you know what I mean? Like the very, very last scene where they, after he's lost the club and he's kind of lost everything, and they're all just like, oh, whatever, and he's up on the roof of this building, and it's him and Rob Gretton and like the two guys from Happy Mondays, and they're up there like smoking weed that Sean Ryder got in Barbados, and there's a great scene at the end where Tony Wilson sees God, except it's him, but it's like floating up at the sky, and he's got like a big gray beard and like shit on it. He's got like all this gold shit behind him. And he tells him like how, you know, he was the guy that did all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. And then, so then like Tony Wilson turns around to the other guys and goes, I've just seen God. And they're like, what? And he's like, yeah, I just saw God. They're like, what did he look like? Well, he looked like me. He was like the spitting image of me. And then he says something like, he says, well, doesn't that say that in the Bible? It's like God created man in his own image. And then there's a pause. And then Rob Gretton goes, yeah, but he didn't say a specific man. It's just like the tone of his voice is just like so fucking perfect. But I don't know. There's something, like I said, I think I really, really like the whole, I mean, because this is about a time period that that I really am into, and a lot of music that I'm really into. So I probably like it maybe more than somebody that wasn't into this kind of music. But there is something just like, there's such a great energy to this movie. Like I said, it's very anarchic. I really like how it sort of like blends you know, reality, but also kind of like legend, but it'll tell you like maybe this didn't happen this way, but this is more interesting, so we're showing this instead. It's just got such a great like punk rock energy to it. And, you know, and it's just really interesting. And I think like all of the kind of scenes are very, the way that it's all played is very, very organic and very naturalistic. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know. I just always really, really liked this movie. I liked the other Joy Division movie too, Control. But that was more, like I said, that was more like an Ian Curtis biopic. That was based on his wife Deborah's, his widow's book. But this one is kind of more sort of based. You know what's interesting? I think Tony Wilson's wife at the time, Lindsay, who is in this movie. Well, she's not in this movie, but there's an actress playing her. She wrote a book with, I can't remember who she, maybe it was Mick Mittles, who was also like a real big, he wrote books about the Smiths and shit like that. And they wrote a book about this whole time period. They wrote a book about Ian Curtis. And actually, I looked into buying it. I was going to buy it from the UK, but it's like fucking £50. And I was like, God damn it. So it must be, I think it's like a limited edition or something. Maybe I can get it cheaper over here someplace. But I would actually kind of like to read that. And yeah, it's, I don't know. It is kind of like cool how they kind of like go all into this. And honestly, the one scene, I saw this in the theater actually when it first came out. And the one scene where Ian Curtis dies, what happened?
I'm just hearing things over there.
Oh. The one scene where Ian Curtis dies and then they're all like at his funeral or whatever, and then he goes in there to, you know, to kind of like pay his last respects or whatever, and then Atmosphere starts playing, and then like he just kind of kisses his forehead and he says, bye, son. Mm. And it's like, ugh. Ugh. That makes me so sad. But yeah, so it's, the movie's not, I mean, the movie's actually really, really funny, more than anything. I mean, it's fucking hilarious. The whole shit about that whole great scene where they're at that club and, like, he goes back in the van, like, with that other guy. There's, like, hookers out there, and he's getting, like, a blowjob from a hooker, like, in the back of this van.
His wife.
His wife comes out and, like, opens the thing, and she's just kind of like, huh, okay. Yeah. And then she immediately goes back in the club and starts humping, like, Howard Devoto from the Buzzcocks in a... Yeah. In a bathroom stall.
Yeah, he goes out there to find them. He's like, they're in there, and he goes down the stall, and he's got her fucking, he's doing it. And she just looks at him like, yeah. And then he goes, what's it? And he goes into her purse. He says, what you got? You know, this.
He's looking for the keys.
Looking for the keys, yeah.
And then
he hold it against her. I mean, fuck.
And then he says, I just got a blowjob. That's full penetration. Okay?
Yeah, right,
just
saying. Yeah.
And then he just leaves.
But what can he say? What can he say?
That's true. Yeah. And then on the way out, like the real Howard Devoto, who is playing like a janitor, he's like cleaning the sink, and he like turns to the camera and says, I definitely don't remember this happening. Yeah. But it's just, so that's kind of how, like, it's very meta and it's very like self-referential. But I don't know. I fucking love this movie. If you're at all into you know, post-punk or any of the kind of shit that happened in England, this does actually, even though it's kind of crazy and, you know, sort of melds fact and fiction together, it is actually a really good examination of not only Manchester almost being kind of like the center of the post-punk explosion, because so many bands came from there, but also being the center of the rave thing, which is crazy that it was like the same city that was sort of like I said, ground zero for both of these massive, like, musical youth movements. And so it does, a really good job. And it's honestly, even though it's not, like, a biopic and it doesn't follow, like, little beats, it's kind of all over the place. But I think, in a way, that makes it a little bit more truthful. Is that weird to say? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't really, like, stick to, like, fact, but it does kind of, like... And the guy that plays Martin Hannett... in this, who produced Joy Division, and it was a complete lunatic, and that was the same guy that played Gollum in the Lord of the Rings movies. That was Andy Serkis under all that stuff. And then it's funny, like, he gets fucking fat at the end.
Yeah.
And then they show him, like, he dies, he has a heart attack, and, like, there's this massive fucking coffin, and they're kind of
wouldn't fit in the hole.
And it wouldn't fit in the hole.
Dude goes, he was too big for death.
It's so great. Yeah. It's just like, I don't know. I just fucking love this movie. I love the whole British sense of humor. I love all the music in this. It's just so fun and, like, so energetic. And everybody that's into post-punk or new wave or any or rave or anything like that should probably watch this, because I feel like it's kind of like required viewing. I hope Nick does watch it.
Yeah, he said he's gonna watch it.
Now he's only like 21 or 22, yeah, 21. Right? That's like our friend, because yeah. Or he calls him his son.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's only 21 or 22, and but he's really, really into like old school. Like, he loves Joy Division and Christian yeah. Death and all that kind of stuff. And we were like, yeah, you gotta see this fucking movie, because this movie is, like, a fucking... It's a blast. It's really, really fun. And honestly, I'd seen it, like, a shit ton of times, because I have it on DVD. But I was, like, really excited to get to watch it again, because I haven't seen it in several years. And it's always, always a good time. Yeah, Fourth Row Down says, Peter Hook told the story of how the band were persuaded by a Fairlight synth, which was £2,000 in 1982. Yeah, that's a lot of money. Meanwhile, he could only afford to put a gallon of gas in his car per week.
Damn.
Yeah, pretty much. You know. Fourth Row Down also says, I actually went to the Hacienda in 1986 to see the Jesus and Mary Chain. Oh, lucky you. I never got to see them.
I forgot all about that band.
I loved the Jesus and Mary Chain, and I never got to see them. It was so loud that my ears actually hurt afterwards. I could see that. They were a very, very loud band. All that feedback. But yeah. You all right?
Yeah.
How long is the food going to be?
Probably another half hour. We'll see. Less. Oh, okay. Depends on when I'm done here.
But yeah. You had a good time with this movie, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I liked it.
So yeah. But yeah. If you're at all into British music from that time period, then yeah, you really have to see this movie, because it's super fun. It came out in 2002. Did we mention that? Yeah, came out in 2002. So definitely watch
20
it.
20 years old.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's still, like, a lot of fun. Yeah. And, yeah, I would definitely recommend it. Probably one of my favorite movies of all time. Never stops being funny to me. So, yeah, I guess that'll do it for today's show. I don't know what we're going to watch tonight. We'll find something to talk about tomorrow. Maybe we'll do, I don't know. So I was going to say maybe we'll do another British movie, since we've done two, but it doesn't really matter. We can just watch whatever. So, yeah, thanks for dropping by today. And we will see you guys again talking about another movie tomorrow. Bye.